This podcast is generously sponsored by the Pillar Network. The Pillar Network is a community of SBC and International Baptist churches that are doctrinally aligned, missionally driven, and committed to equipping, planting, and revitalizing churches together. If you're a pastor of an established church and you're desiring to lead your congregation to plant churches, but you're not sure how to get started, Pillar could be a great resource for you. Reach out to them today at thepillarnetwork.com. Thepillarnetwork.com.
Baptist 21 is a pastor-led voice for Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The B21 podcast will discuss current issues in the SBC with Southern Baptist church leaders. To check out more resources, visit us at baptist21.com.
Welcome to the Baptist 21 podcast. I'm Nate Aiken, director of Baptist 21. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations about what it means to be Baptist in the 21st century. And so I have with me today, Andrew Walker. I'm going to have Andrew kind of tell us a little bit about himself, what he's doing right now. And then we're going to have some conversations around politics and social ethics, religious liberty, just several of the things that are going on. And so, Andrew, thanks for being on the podcast.
Nate, it's great to be with you.
So, Andrew, just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of just brief testimony, how you came to know the Lord, and then kind of what got you into ministry and then what you do now in ministry.
Sure. So my testimony is pretty wild. I grew up in a Christian home, thought I was a Christian and was one of the good moral kids, was in charge of my FCA, but realized it was more or less a kind of a costume I was wearing. And then in October of 2000, a girl in our youth group stood up and gave her testimony, and she was the pastor's daughter, and she talked about how she was playing the game, or how she, before she was a Christian, she knew she was playing the game, that she was just going to church because she was a part of a Christian family. And I'll never forget, the Holy Spirit used that language of playing the game to awaken my heart, and I realized, like, that was my situation. It was more moralistic than it was trusting in Christ. And after that young lady gave her testimony, afterwards, I told my youth pastor, said, "Hey, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I don't think I'm a believer." And so my youth pastor and I, and he called this other girl back to come talk with me. And I prayed to receive Christ that night. And the cool thing is that girl I ended up marrying. So,
kind of
a cool little story there. Yeah. So my wife is responsible for the testimony that led to my conversion. And so went to Southwest Baptist University and thought I was going to become a pastor or a professor, and then went on to Southern Seminary thinking I'd be a pastor or professor, and was still wrestling with what my call to ministry really looked like, and needed to find a job in 2010 to help care for my family, and got led into this kind of public policy and advocacy sphere. And that led me for 2 years to work for an organization here in Kentucky, then for the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and then for about 6 years at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, where during that time I completed my PhD. And eventually I'm here at Southern Seminary now. And it was crazy. One of my mentors told me that back in 2008, he'd asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, someday teach ethics at Southern Seminary. And so when I finally got this role to teach ethics at Southern Seminary, my friend reminded me of that. And it's just a reminder of the Lord's kind providence and how, you know, you really can't plot your journey. There's a lot of jagged edges and jagged lines. It's not really a straight line. And so I'm here at the seminary teaching survey of ethics, biomedical ethics, church and state, public theology issues, and love what I get to do. I can't believe I get paid for a living to write and teach about these issues, and care a lot about, obviously, ethics. Our public witness, what that relates to in the public square about the social implications of the gospel, and care a lot about religious liberty, as you know. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, plan to spend the next 30 plus years at Southern Seminary camped out teaching ethics and training pastors.
That's good. So your goal in life was to be an ethics prophet at Southern Seminary. So what does it feel like to reach all your goals at such a young age?
Well, I guess at 35 and having attained what I aspired to back in 2008, I guess I can just coast off into irrelevance now. So
that's all. That's awesome. So you got saved in your teenage years?
Yeah, I got saved. Actually, this is crazy to say, but I know the date and time that I accepted Christ. I accepted Christ on Wednesday night, October 25th, 2000, at 7:43 p.m. Because as I was praying to receive Christ, my youth pastor was giving thanks to God. Oh, wow. And he said, "I'm so thankful that at 7:43 p.m., we have a new brother in Christ."
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And I remember, it is. And I remember afterwards, I went to Walmart with my mom. I was 15 and I stayed in the car while she went in. And I remember our Walmart was like across the road from our church. And I remember sitting in the car crying because I felt like this massive burden had been taken off of my shoulders. And I remember just kind of crying as a 15-year-old, thinking about the fact that I've had my sins forgiven, that I am at peace with God. And that's one of the reasons I would say that I've ended up becoming such a fervent Baptist, is because we rely so explicitly on conversion and regeneration. Yeah, and I just don't know of a Christian faith. And I'm not trying to discount my Presbyterian or Anglican brothers and sisters. But, you know, I do think that this notion of regenerate church membership and conversionary Christianity is really, really important.
That's really good. Okay, so you teach bioethics and ethics at Southern, probably some electives and other courses as well. What did you write on? So dissertation, and then I think you also have a book coming out soon. We'll talk about that at the end of the podcast, but just, what did you kind of write on dissertation? Any other areas that you kind of do a good bit of work in?
Yeah, so I did my dissertation on religious liberty in evangelical social ethics, and was basically doing two main things, making the argument that evangelicals have really not systematically thought through religious liberty. We've kind of treated it as a haphazard afterthought, that it's a useful social doctrine that helps accrue certain social privileges for all people in society. But we really hadn't thought about it through a more theological grid or lens. And so my dissertation argued that religious liberty is not an afterthought to Christianity. It's central to Christian thought. And I argued for kind of a theory of religious liberty along the lines of eschatology, anthropology, and missiology. And as you mentioned, I have an adaptation of my dissertation coming out this May called Liberty for All with Brazos Press. So that's the first book plug. Maybe we'll have another before.
Definitely would like to have you. Yeah, absolutely. Would love to have you talk about that. We've been trying to do a series on Baptist distinctives, and one of the few we haven't covered yet has been religious liberty. And so maybe we could have another interview later on where we just talk specifically about where that comes from in the scriptures, how we've held to it historically as Baptists, and then how it addresses the current day, which we'll talk about some in this interview as well. Well, so there's obviously in the areas of religious liberty, ethics, public policy, there's tons to talk about. Let me just start with a big question, and then we'll kind of go from there. Kind of in your areas of religious liberty, ethics, politics, public policy, public witness, what would you say you're encouraged by right now from Christians and from Baptists? And what are you discouraged by from Christians and from Baptists?
My heavens, that's a good question. There's looking at the current moment, there's not a whole lot to be encouraged by, if I'm being honest. There's more of reasons for discouragement. I will confess that I'm a kind of a short-term pessimist and long-term optimist. But I will say, I think that in recent years, I think we are learning some of how unhealthy our political allegiances have resulted in. And I think that we have an opportunity to kind of emerge out of things with a little bit better of a public theology. And I think that, and I know we might talk about this issue of kind of Christian nationalism, but I think we have an opportunity to do some better work and thinking about relating our faith in Christ to what it means to be a patriot and a citizen. And I don't think those things are at odds whatsoever. It's about understanding what the jurisdictions and roles are of the church and the state and the citizen and the Christian. So I think this is just an opportunity for us to have some fertile conversation about the way forward.
Well, let's jump into that then. And thinking through kind of political allegiances, you use the term, and it's been a term that's thrown around a ton right now, Christian nationalism. Maybe just ask a couple questions there around it. What is it? So how would you define it? I know I've been in conversations before where somebody's saying, well, tell me, define that for me. So maybe let's define it. How does it manifest itself? And then is it an accurate label of Southern Baptists? Is it an accurate label of American evangelicals? So yeah, tell us kind of how, when you think through that term, Christian nationalism, what is it and how does it kind of manifest itself?
Well, a part of the problem is that Christian nationalism has become a part of the common vernacular at this point. And my fear is that Christian nationalism has become kind of a catch-all category for anything we just don't like about conservative Christians. So, oh, there's these conservative Christians over here who voted this certain way. They're all terrible. Let's put them in the basket of deplorables and, you know, basically remove them off to the margins of society. That's a mistake. Christian nationalism can't just be a catch-all category for things we dislike about conservative Christianity. I do think Christian nationalism does exist, but you're right. It needs to be very carefully defined. And I think a few of those benchmark identifiers would be anyone who thinks that America and Christianity share some type of commingling relationship where one reinforces the other. And I think potentially the idea that Christianity is used as a prop to legitimize the state and the culture, and to more or less make the argument that Christianity ought to be given some type of legal, cultural, political privilege over against other types of religions in society. So I do think it exists. That said, I want to be very careful. I think that Christianity has tremendous roles to play in society. It's a place for us to find our moral bearings. And I believe society has to have a thick conception of some type of moral agreements for society to be inhabitable. I think the question then becomes is if we think that is true of our Christian faith, does it mean that we then instrumentalize our Christian faith so that we care more about what the Christian faith nets us in society than what it nets us in terms of our individual walks with Christ? So if attaining a Christian culture is more important than seeing friends and neighbors come to Christ, that's a problem. Now, on the other hand, if Christians influencing culture means that pastors are preaching and transforming consciences and consciences are voting in accordance with the principles of righteousness, that's totally fine. It's all a matter of what are you aiming at? Are you aiming at culture or are you aiming at conversion? If you aim at culture, you're going to get a lot of paganized pretend Christians. If you aim at the church and aim at conversion, you're going to get people who are then just simply working out the implications of their faith in all walks of life.
GuideStone's Mission Dignity Ministry exists to honor retirement-age Southern Baptist pastors, workers, and their widows through advocacy and financial assistance. Mission Dignity provides monthly grants to almost 1,700 recipients across the country, helping them pay bills, buy medications, and cover other basic expenses. Mission Dignity needs your help identifying more people to serve. If you know someone who is 65 years of age or older, has 10 or more years of Southern Baptist service and experience, could use a little extra help, please refer them to missiondignity.org/refer-someone-in-need. You can also call 1-877-888-9409 or email missiondignity@guidestone.org to learn more about this ministry. You tweeted this recently kind of in this vein. So criticisms of Christian nationalism are legitimate insofar as the events that have unfolded as of late are related. But Biden's generic expression of religious nationalism is also wasting no time in uniting America under the banner of national piety. And you put this is genuinely fascinating. Tell me what you meant by that tweet and kind of unpack that for us.
Yeah. So to me, I really do marvel at the ways in which religion is either approved or disapproved of in society. And kind of a general theme that I notice is that progressives and liberals tend to love religion when religion favors their political outcomes. But if it doesn't favor their political outcomes, it is, you know, you automatically hear appeals to the separation of church and state, and, you know, you can't legislate morality. But if religion furthers a progressive end, everyone seems to all of a sudden be totally fine with religion. And you can compare this with New York Times reports about Biden's use of religious language in his career versus how the New York Times talked about Amy Coney Barrett. So right. Amy Coney Barrett, you know, this very conservative Catholic, she's more or less this, you know, cultish freak, according to the New York Times, because she actually believes what the Catholic magisterium teaches. But Joe Biden, because he's a liberal Catholic who has, by the way, basically dispensed with every teaching of the Catholic magisterium that secularism objects to, it's just interesting. It's a contrast of the use of religion in society.
You've mentioned kind of obviously using kind of Christian principles, virtues that would come straight out of the scriptures, informing how we vote and how we engage in the public sphere. So not talking about those that could be identified as Christian nationalists. So again, this maybe unhealthy tie between being Christian equals being Republican, or this kind of energy and fervor that gets behind at times and using religious language behind a candidate or a party. Do you think, though, given kind of where the culture's moving, and as you talk about this, that we will progressively, or progressively is the wrong word, we will increasingly be called fundamentalists for holding to certain fundamentals of the faith? And should we just be ready for that?
I think that's absolutely the case. And I think the move right now happening in the broader culture is to not simply make the statement that Christians are wrong about their beliefs about sexuality, or, for example, the relationship between faith and science. The move right now is to attack the very credibility of Christianity from being a plausible way to identify and live in society, insofar as Christianity is construed as being harmful to people. So if in the popular mind, Christianity is seen as a puppet for white supremacy, sexism, and, you know, used as a battering ram against a LGBT population, then the move by progressives is going to be to simply say that Christians are wrong, not by virtue of misusing their beliefs, but the very essence and nature of their beliefs are mistaken. And so for Christians to move forward, they're going to need to jettison core essential components of the Christian faith, which we cannot do. We just will not do.
So in this area, I mean, this comes up a ton during elections, and you tweeted about this several times. It's actually the first thing that kind of sparked, like, I'd love to get him on the podcast, because really you articulated some things I was thinking, but just much, much better and much more clear than I could. But that's around the area of public witness, and you've done study on this. I'm just going to read a tweet that you put out around the election, but this is helpful. It's actually well before the election, but in this conversation, use it to set up the question. I've never heard of a non-Christian express admiration for the public witness of Christianity that didn't first imply agreement with the issue at hand, which you've mentioned already on this podcast. It is as though this is a self-invented term we have created to hold ourselves hostage to unbelievers' expectations. Then in another tweet, you said this, and I'm going to ask a follow-up question on this. So first, just want to kind of hear, I'll wait and read that tweet. First, I want to hear kind of your thoughts. What do you mean when you're talking about this idea of public witness? You would obviously affirm there is such thing as public witness, but with this tweet, what are your concerns around that topic, particularly in a hot topic season as we find around election time?
Well, I want to first off say that public witness is absolutely a legitimate, credible term. We are commanded in the New Testament to be mindful of how the outside world views us. So I want to give, on the one hand, the recognition that Christians are to have integrity. We aren't to be charlatans or hacks in terms of our interactions and attitudes with non-believers. The problem is if you are making the argument that our public witness is more or less all that matters about the intellectual plausibility and credibility of Christianity, what it says is you're leaving the opinion of Christianity in the hands of those who disagree with Christianity. And so, of course, non-believers are going to like the areas of Christianity where Christianity agrees with them. So everyone agrees it's a good thing to feed and clothe the poor. So progressives will love our public witness right there. But all of a sudden, when the same tribe of Christians stand up and say, well, we should feed and clothe the poor, but also marriage is only the union of a man and a woman. Oh, and by the way, abortion is wrong and a man cannot become a woman. All of a sudden, the idea that we've been accepted by our culture despisers is withered away. And so at the end of the day, what results is progressives will only like the areas that Christianity agrees with them, and where we disagree with them, we're never going to do enough to make progressives like us. Progressives will only like Christians if Christians let go of the theology that progressives don't like. And so we might feed and clothe the poor like Southern Baptist Disaster Relief does. And so progressives will like that. But at the same time, at the annual convention, we'll pass a resolution on the good of the natural family. So then all of a sudden, all we really are in the eyes of the world are just a bunch of really nice bigots who also feed and clothe the poor, but we're still bigots.
Right. Mm. That's helpful. Another time you kind of tweeted about public witness, and you said this, that it's a public witness is a term used by some Christians to bring other Christians who dissent from the secular frame into submission. It measures public acceptability and reasonableness according to the canons of unbelief, which leads to punching rightward and coddling leftward. So I want to unpack this kind of idea, punch rightward, coddle left. I would say in just conversations, this has been an area where people just kind of seem to take a step back and say, what has happened, particularly among Christians, evangelical Christians, where it's become much more common to punch right and to coddle left. What did you mean by this tweet? And what do you think this is that we're talking about?
Well, I think there's a particular type of Christian who is so deferential to the outside world's opinion that any time Christians are seen doing anything wrong, it's an opportunity to pounce on the hypocrisy of Christians. And listen, we're all sinners. Christians screw up. We sin. We act like hypocrites occasionally. The question is, are you going to spend the majority of your time online throwing your Christian brothers and sisters under the bus and just simply allowing elites or progressives to have all of their contempt confirmed for conservative Christians? Or will you do, I would say, a far more intellectually honest thing, which is to simply call balls and strikes on both sides? So I said this just a second ago. Public witness absolutely matters. Integrity matters. We have to have intellectual consistency. But if we think that's going to be what makes the world like us, that's not a New Testament principle. Show me in the New Testament where our intellectual consistency and our credibility in the eyes of the world led to mass evangelism and mass conversion. We have to hold two things in common. We have to hold in tension, but they're not really in contradiction. We have to hold these realities that we are called to have integrity, to act with faith, to act with charity, while I also recognize that all of that can be pursued with a good conscience and will still be met with scorn and disbelief and mockery by the outside world.